This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, a conversation with writer Richard B. Wright. His novel, Clara Callan, was published to great acclaim last year in Canada. Wright was awarded both the Giller Prize and the Governor General's Award in 2001 for Clara Callan, and this fall he received the Trillium Book Award. Thanks to the awards for Clara Callan, readers in the U.S. may now be discovering Wright, who's the author of 8 previous novels, including The Age of Longing and Sunset Manor. Clara Callan is now available in the U.S., published by HarperCollins. The novel tells the story of 2 sisters over the course of a few years in the 1930s. The novel begins in 1934. Clara is teaching school in Whitfield, a village in Ontario, while her sister Nora is heading off to New York City to pursue a career as a radio soap opera star. The narrative uses the correspondence between Clara and Nora, as well as Clara's journals, to tell the story. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation with questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to use. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Richard Wright, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, and congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. You know, without a good deal of acclaim, I would imagine it's got to be tough for a Canadian writer to receive much attention in the U.S.
Well, it is. You know, the American market is a big one. It's very competitive. Instead of having perhaps 100 novels published a year or in the fall season, which is in Canada, you probably have 1,000 in the United States. So it's a much vaster and more competitive market.
Hmm. There are a couple of Canadian writers, though you among them now, that have come to our attention here south of the border. Yann Martel.
Yes, Yann Martel, who won the Booker Prize in London just last month.
Yeah, and Michael Ondaatje.
Yeah, Michael Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood.
Alice
Munro are names that might be familiar to some American readers.
Yeah, well, I look forward to hearing more from writers north of our border. Why did you decide to set this novel, Clara Callan, in the 1930s?
Well, the 1930s has always been a particular interest of mine. I remember my parents talking about raising us during the... I was born just towards the end of that decade, so I don't remember anything firsthand, but I do recall my parents talking about it when I was a child and the difficulties that they faced. We were a large family, and I was I'm sort of interested in the artifacts and the popular culture of the 30s, and always have been. The radio shows, I grew up with radio, really, and I remember the soap operas and the comedy shows on radio in the 40s and early 50s, really before television came up to Canada. So it's just been the period has just provided general interest for me over the years.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to do a lot of research then on the history of the period?
Well, I did. I did a lot of reading of the newspapers of the day, American and Canadian. And I read fairly widely from the letters, collected letters and diaries of people like Edna St. Vincent Millay and Marianne Moore and Louise Bogan, women writers of the 30s. And I found those documents fascinating.
Mm. Well, throughout the book, there are references to the popular culture of the day, which is really a lot of fun to read.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting time. I mean, it was the time in which radio was king. It was paramount among the media, with maybe movies coming a close second. But everyone listened to the radio, and I'm sure there will be older listeners today who can remember tuning in to programs, and people were really glued to the radio, and the radio brought the news of the world to small towns and farms and villages all throughout North America. So radio was king in the 1930s.
Yeah. What kind of radio programs would Nora be involved in and Clara be listening to?
Well, Nora goes to New York with the idea of becoming... She had been an amateur actress, and so she went off to New York to try her hand at radio in what were called radio soap operas, and they were really the precursors of the kind of soap operas people now watch. And these were legion. There were dozens of them on the air, and they had millions of listeners, mostly housewives, who in those days, of course, they were women were more confined. They were in their homes ironing or doing the dishes or whatever. And these radio soap operas like Ma Perkins and Pepper Young's Family, the Right to Happiness, Big Sister, they were immensely popular. So those are the kinds of programs that Nora became involved in, although she did, there were a lot of crime dramas on radio in those days too, The Shadow and Gangbusters, I can remember those, and she did some bit parts on in those kinds of programs too. So what you had on radio in the 1930s was really a combination of comedy, mystery, and drama, much as you probably have on television now. With maybe a little more emphasis on drama.
And of course there were advertisements.
Oh yes, plenty of advertising. You know, I mean, this is really what made a number of the large companies grow. Companies like Lever Brothers and Procter and Gamble were very heavily into the radio serials in the afternoon, and of course they sold just tons and tons of soap.
Yeah.
And so yes, there was a lot of advertising, and but I loved all those ads, and when I was a kid, listening to them. Interestingly enough, we had our own kind of soap operas up here, but they were never as good as the Americans. So I used to listen along with my mother when I was just a child to all these American stations, American programs. A lot of them coming from Chicago. Oddly enough, Chicago was a spot where a lot of radio drama originated. So we grew up really with a lot of American radio, and I'm sure I wasn't alone. It always seemed a little more exciting. I don't know.
Yeah, that it was American?
Yeah. You know, it was sort of exotic and different, and so when we listened to The Shadow or Gangbusters, we were listening to, you know, stuff that was coming out of New York or Chicago, and that always seemed exotic and interesting.
Mm, very interesting. What inspired you to use letters and journal entries to tell this story?
Well, I had tried to write the novel in a conventional way, but I found that I couldn't quite get the voice of the two sisters. And really, when I was part of the way through it, I decided that they would probably be exchanging letters. After all, they were 500 miles apart, one woman in New York City, the other in a small Ontario village, and they would write letters. This was before email and before telephones were as common as they are. So I tried to write a few of these letters, and then I liked what I saw, and I seemed to feel I'd captured the voices of the two women within these letters, and so I decided that I would really write the whole novel in letter form with occasional diary entries from Clara, who is the more reflective and thoughtful of the two sisters, and she's the kind of woman who would have kept a journal. And those journal entries allowed us to see a little more intimate glimpse into Clara's life.
Mm-hmm. In those entries, she can be a little more open than she can, even in correspondence with her sister, her only sibling.
Well, right, and there are many things that happen to her that she's reluctant to reveal even to her sister, including some fairly dramatic and traumatic things. But it's natural, but it was even more common in those days to not to be quite so open in everything. The whole idea of full disclosure now is a fairly recent phenomenon, I think, and people were a little more reluctant to reveal their true selves in those days.
Yeah. And even if difficulties abounded, these women just pick up and they go on. They don't sit back and do too much crying.
No, they don't do. They didn't do too much complaining, and they certainly couldn't find any counseling or help if they suffered. And I can say that in the novel, Clara suffers a rape. And, you know, I mean, this was a small village, and I'm sure it would have been the same in Illinois. You felt just so ashamed of the whole experience that you couldn't really tell anyone. And certainly this was Clara's predicament, and she eventually turns to her sister for help. But again, she doesn't even reveal that she's been raped. She's pregnant as a result of this, and Nora just assumes that she's had some kind of an affair. And such was the reluctance on the part of women in those days. I mean, I've talked to older women, and they've confirmed this, that you really were very, very loath to tell people too much about your emotional life. And this was the case, certainly, with the Callan sisters.
Yeah. And even Clara, in her small-town life, she realizes that she knows that not going, quitting going to church is, you know, is pretty daring. And then to tell someone that you've lost your faith, that also is quite daring for her situation.
Well, for the times.
Yeah.
And after the death of her father, I mean, Clara was the kind of woman who had attended church every day, really from the time she was a small child with her father. And then a series of just intimations or whatever it was within her, she began to lose her faith. And this was a very, very shattering experience for her. And of course, it provoked a lot of comment when it's discovered that she's no longer going to church. I mean, Sunday morning service was the focal point of the community's week. And when Clara no longer turns up at church, she's the topic of a lot of conversation, and the minister comes around to visit her. And, you know, there's this sort of community involvement that you would never have today, I don't think, even in small towns today, because we live in a more secular age where, I mean, it's just not taken as, religion just isn't taken as seriously by most people. Certainly it's taken seriously by many, but not as much as it was back in those days. So Clara has a number of things to overcome in living in that very tightly confined era community.
Hmm. I would think, though, that life in small towns could still be pretty restrictive in terms of how you live your life, how openly you live your life.
You mean nowadays?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure, but I'm not convinced that people today have the same. I'm not convinced that people today have the same. Their noses in everybody's business, perhaps quite the way it was 70 or 80 years ago, when you really couldn't move without people knowing what was going on. For example, if you did have a telephone, the chances are it was a party line, and people were listening in on what you were doing. There really is a little more privacy in people's lives today. They can get into cars and leave and so on. So I think it was a little tougher in those days to maintain your privacy.
Yeah. Well, today you can get on the internet and you can go anywhere and be anybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Perhaps you would read an excerpt at this point in our conversation this afternoon to give listeners a sense of Clara and the relationship she has with her sister. And I'm thinking of a point in the story where Clara is coming back from New York after calling on her sister for help in her situation after being raped.
Yeah, do you know the page?
Page 88.
Okay, page 88, all
right. Page 88, that's where this segment begins. It's a journal entry is where we begin. Sunday, August 11th. She's still in New York.
She's still in New York City, and she's gone through a very difficult experience. And she's sort of explaining what she's been doing in New York with her sister, and how difficult it is to tell her the truth.
Yeah.
So this is dated, this all takes place in 1935. It's Sunday, August the 11th. Yesterday, Nora took me to the Automat on 42nd Street. It is an enormous restaurant with hundreds of tables, but the food is kept in locked glass cases along the walls. To get your sandwich or piece of pie, you must insert a nickel or dime into a slot. I found it a very strange way to eat, but New Yorkers seem to take this kind of thing as if it were perfectly routine. I wonder if all restaurants will be like this in 10 years. Later, we went to Radio City Music Hall and saw a vaudeville show and a picture. Then we talked far into the night, lying there side by side in her funny little pull-out bed. Nora is doing well down here, but she is also discontented. Turning 30 has left her troubled. She would like to marry and have children before it is too late. She hinted that she and the announcer have been flirting a bit, nothing serious. Besides, he's married, and so that could lead nowhere. At one point, Nora got up for a glass of water and then returned, falling into bed and staring at the ceiling as though entirely fed up with things. I remember her doing this at home after an argument with Father, storming into the room and collapsing on the bed, her sudden weight jarring the book I was reading. Last night, as I lay there, she seemed embittered. I am going home on Monday, and she may have felt, and I could hardly blame her, that in return for all she had done, she was at least owed an explanation. She said, "I wonder what I would do if it happened to me." In the light from the window overlooking the street, I could see her angry little pout. She used to put on the same face when she felt unjustly dealt with by Father. Men just walk away from these things and leave the dirty work to us. I'll bet the bastard who got you pregnant is now snoring away beside his little wife. He didn't have to take a taxi up into Darky Town in the middle of the night, did he? I could see she wanted me to reveal the identity of the villain, but my heart was not open to confession. I wasn't about to tell Nora the sordid details of my encounter with the tramp. She wanted a love story. Assignations, letters, meetings in cars on country roads, whispered embraces, and the fluttering of hearts in hopeless passion. But since it wasn't like that, the tale was beyond me. "One day, Nora," I said, "I will tell you all about it."
And that's the journal entry. I would also like you to read the letter then that Clara sends Nora upon her return to Whitfield. But before I do that, I want to ask you this. How does the relationship between these two sisters change over the course of these years?
How does it change over the course of the novel?
Mm-hmm.
I think as the book progresses slowly, Clara is prepared to reveal a little more about herself, and eventually she will tell Nora the details of the rape by those two strangers. But even at the end of the book, I think that there's something that Clara holds back because she is that kind of a woman. She's not emotionally open to revealing things for us, whereas Nora lays it all out on the line. She's just that kind of a person. And so I think that it although Clara does reveal a little more about herself as it moves on, she's still a little bit reluctant to tell everything about herself.
Mm. Well, now would you read the letter that she writes her sister Nora upon her return to Ontario?
Can you give me that page number?
It's 89.
89.
It follows right there.
Okay. Whitfield, Ontario. Saturday, August the 17th, 1935. Dear Nora, I wanted to write you before this, but I have been busy with the house, dusty, and the yard untidy, though Mr. Bryden thoughtfully cut the grass in my absence. I also overworked myself a bit, and for a little while on Thursday felt feverish and faint, so I took to my bed and pretended that I was merely enduring the vapors of a spinster lady in her middle years. Now, however, I'm feeling hale again. You will find enclosed a money order for my train fare to New York and back. Again, I cashed in the sleeping car ticket, so that amount is included as well. How can I begin to thank you for everything you've done over the past month? I'm certain that you and Evelyn Dowling literally saved me from ruin. I can't imagine what would have become of me without your help. So, Nora, I am in your debt now and forever. Everyone in the village has plucked me by the sleeve at the post office or butcher's shop to ask about my trip to New York City. It has made me at least temporarily quite the exotic traveler. Everyone is agog, don't get to use that word very often, when I tell them that you are now on the radio in New York. My, how that impresses them. Cora McFarlane. I always thought Nora would make something of herself. I said that to people when she used to do those nice recitations at the Christmas concerts. and sing why she had a voice like a bird. So there you are, heroine in your hometown. Everyone wants to know when they can hear your program, and I said I thought it might be heard sometime this fall through one of the Toronto stations. Was I right about that? My trip, of course, made today's Herald under the rubric of Whitfield Notes. Here it is in all its glory. Miss Clara Callan has returned after spending the summer weeks visiting her sister Nora in New York City. Miss Nora Callan is now appearing in the radio show The Home on Chestnut Street. Well, they got some of it right anyway. In the post office yesterday, the odious Ida Atkins pestered me to write something for the Church Bulletin, my impressions of New York City. I wonder what she would think if I were to describe a certain hot and thundery Friday night in Harlem. I could, of course, mention that Harlem is named after a city in Holland. They enjoy such details. But I didn't see any Dutchmen that night, did you? As you can tell, I'm feeling quite gay and buoyant. What happened to me, Nora, was such a burden, and now that it's been lifted, I feel renewed and eager to get on with things. To get back to school, to ordinary routines, to life, however pedestrian and mundane it might be. I know that in a few weeks or a few days, I will sink, like everyone else, into the petty griping that accompanies daily life wherever it is lived. But right now, I take delight in waking, in the opening petals of a flower, in playing my piano. Everything is charged with a special music, what I might call the perfectly ordinary day. I had hoped to write a poem about how it takes deliverance from disaster to make us feel grateful for that perfectly ordinary day, but alas, I can't seem to find the words. Well, never mind. If I can't write poetry, at least perhaps I can try to think and feel like a poet. I must make some supper now and then put my feet up. The summer is drawing to a close. The exhibition opens a week from today, and I have agreed to go with the ladies on the 29th for an outing. But I do enjoy the X. Remember when Father would take us for the day? I began to look forward to it as soon as school was out. About the middle of August has always been the happiest time in the calendar for me. Anyway, we're going down on the 29th for the day. I shall drop E.D. a note tomorrow and thank her for everything else she did. I found her rather remarkable, though her destructive habits were a little unnerving to a Puritan bumpkin like me. From the bottom of my heart, Nora, thank you again for everything. Clara.
Richard B. Wright reading from his novel, Clara Callan. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Richard Wright is our guest here on the program this afternoon. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. The telephone number is in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, Clara, she would be a poet. She tells her sister in this letter, well, never mind, if I can't write poetry, at least perhaps I can try to think and feel like a poet. Later in a letter to E.D., who is Evelyn Dowling, a writer, she says she has the impulses and sensibility of a poet, but she lacks that other thing. What is it called? She says, oh, yes, talent. But Clara is a poetic soul.
I think she is, but I think a lot of people are. I mean, she has the sensibility of a poet. She may even have the vocation of a poet, but she doesn't really have enough talent to be someone who would be published. I think there are a lot of people like that who want to write, who feel deeply about things, who want to express things. But there's a big difference between feeling like that or being that kind of person and actually being able to do it. And this is one of the frustrations that afflicts Claire, although I think she's pretty realistic about it. She realizes that she doesn't have the talent. You know, there are a lot of people nowadays who really feel they do, and maybe they don't. So she writes poems to herself, and she fills her journal with poetry. But I don't think she ever really seriously considers that she will become a poet. And it reminds me, actually, in a sense, of my own childhood when people often ask me, well, when you were a child, did you feel, or a young person, did you think of becoming a writer? And I think I can tell you that growing up in a small town in Ontario back in the 40s and 50s, the whole idea of becoming a writer for someone like myself was as exotic as, say, wanting to sing at the Met or something. It was just an outlandish ambition. So although I came later than Clara, I think I belong to that generation of people who maybe undervalued themselves in a way, but who didn't really see any future for them in the arts. And it took a while for me to certainly understand that maybe I could, but in Clara's case, because it's 20 years earlier, she doesn't.
Mm. What was it in your life that allowed you to see that writing was a real possibility for you?
Well, I got out of the town. You have to get out of that small village or town to interact with other people and try your hand at things. And I left at 18 and went off and worked at a variety of things before I went to university. And then I eventually ended up working for a publishing company, and I began to do some editorial work there, and I began to see that perhaps some of the stuff I was reading wasn't any better than something I could do myself. But the key to the whole thing was getting out of the town, and of course Clara never gets out of the village.
Hmm. But well, her sister does, but she's quite in a sense she's quite ordinary.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of them, she is ordinary, but she had a good voice. She had some dramatic sense, and she sounded like the girl next door, the girl down the street, and that's exactly what was needed for the role in the radio soap opera. The people who performed on these programs were not great actresses or actors, but they had a presence. They had a kind of neighborliness, so they had something in their voices that made them agreeable to listeners. But they certainly didn't have to be great actors. They had a small talent which they used, and I think Nora fits that category.
Yeah. Well, she can also sell it, whether it's tooth powder or the story, because I have the sense she believes it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just lost you there for a
minute. I think that Nora is successful as an actress because she is gullible in a way. She believes what the lines that she's delivering.
Yeah, and that's what makes her very good. As Evelyn Dowling, who's rather a cynical New York writer, says, you know, she has this innocence about her that shines through in her portrayal of the characters, and everybody can see it, and it makes her oddly vulnerable, but also very very good at what she does. It's sort of inadvertent, her success, in a way.
Mm. Now we've mentioned Evelyn, who's quite an interesting character. She's living her life. She's a woman who's living her life at the edge of convention, I would say.
Yeah, and certainly for the day she is. She's a lesbian. She's a heavy drinker. She's a woman who is prepared to live, as you say, on the boundaries of convention, if not beyond them. And you would think that such a person would be antipathy to Clara, but in fact Clara finds herself liking Evelyn very much. I think she likes the honesty that Evelyn portrays. Although she writes these soap operas and later goes off to Hollywood to write film scripts, she has a kind of candor about her that Clara finds appealing. I think she's also a bit exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And very different from anything or any kind of person that Clara's ever encountered. And of course, Clara sees beneath all this cynicism and kind of artificial big city flavor that she's really a very good-hearted woman.
Mm. When I was reading, I couldn't help but thinking, when I came across Evelyn, of a character perhaps like Dorothy Parker or in a contemporary sense, maybe Fran Lebowitz.
Right. Yeah, very witty, critical of popular culture. She's always making fun of the program that she writes has invented and written. And she's in it for the money, and she's good at what she does, and she's ambitious and eventually goes off to Hollywood and works for Louis B. Mayer. And so she's kind of, in a way, I suppose you could say she's a stereotypical character, a type, if you like. And yet I think she has enough individual touches to make her unique and have her own sort of voice. Hmm. I quite liked her as I as I began to develop her. I began to like her more and more as I got to know her. That sounds strange for the creator of the character, but as I got to know her, I began to like her more and more.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, you have to have characters in a novel that you're writing that you like to spend time with.
Yeah, exactly. And you are spending a lot of time. I mean, this novel took about 3.5 years to write, and I wrote it around a teaching job. I was teaching in a prep school, and so I used to have to get up in the mornings and before I went off to teach and worked on this book. And you're right. If you're going to write a novel, as someone once described the writing of a novel, it's a long journey in a small room. So you really do have to like your company, more or less. Now, there are a couple of people in this book that are clearly villainous, and I didn't like them much, although I enjoyed creating them, but I didn't want to spend a lot of time in their company either.
Yeah. At the outset of this book, readers might think that Clara, you know, is bound for a very conventional life in this small village, but they'll find a very sensitive, interesting woman. What do you find most interesting about her?
Well, I like her sensitivity. I like her thoughtfulness. I like the way she responds to the world around her, even though the world around her is a fairly limited one. Clara is the kind of woman who has found a great deal to discover in a very small world. She goes for long walks. She observes nature. She looks around her world and sees interesting things, sees things that she wants to write about and things she wants to comment on. And I find that's an admirable quality in anyone. She doesn't complain about her situation. Her sister's always complaining about not having a man in her life or not being married. Clara resigns herself to a certain situation and is prepared to live with it. There's a kind of stoicism in her that people might say, well, you know, she doesn't want to break out of that world, but she finds that world satisfying and comforting enough. She likes her house, she likes her village, in spite of the busybodies in it. She even likes her neighbors. She can see the good and the bad in people. I think she's very balanced philosophically, and those are some of the things that I liked about her.
Hmm. As the book has been reviewed and as you've met with readers in Canada and now in the U.S., what's been the reaction to Clara from women?
Yeah, well, the main reaction has been a lot of readers are puzzled at how I managed to provide such an intimate portrait of really three women, but in general, but one woman in particular, particularly the journal entries, which, you know, are fairly intimate glimpses into her inner life. So that has been sort of the main topic of interest. How could a man do this? But there's nothing new about a man writing about a woman or a woman writing about a man. I think you have to cross genders. I don't think you can just people novels with your own sex. You have to be able to imagine what it's like to be someone else. There were things in the novel that I had to ask my wife about, but in the main, it was a question of sort of imagining Clara's sensibility, and I found as I began to write that Clara's sensibility was not unlike my own. I think, you know, that men and women share certain characteristics and certain sensitivities, and I found that that I shared these with Clara. The other thing that readers commented on, of course, was getting the time right. A lot of particularly younger readers were interested in the 1930s because it was a fascinating time to be alive. It wasn't certainly the book doesn't take a nostalgic look at the period because it wasn't the best time to be alive, but it was an interesting time. There were a lot of various ideologies. There were a lot of new technologies coming into play, and it was just I've always thought a very interesting time to be alive, and so a lot of critics have commented on my getting a lot of that into the novel and making the setting of the book interesting to modern readers.
Hmm. What did you turn to your wife for advice?
Well, at the end, I got to give some of this away. I guess at the end of the book, Clara becomes pregnant again. Now, this is through a relationship she has with a married man. And I should say something about that. The whole idea of having an affair, what they used to call an affair, was so fraught with danger in those days, not only because it was easier to become pregnant, but also because, in a small village, everybody knew your business. I've covered that. Mm-hmm. So I think that when she became pregnant, I wanted to convey really what it felt like to be very pregnant, and that's just something that no man can really imagine. So I asked my wife for a couple of images, and she gave them to me, and they were just right. They're there in the book. There are certain things that you can't cross genders with. I mean, you can imagine only so far, and I would often read a passage to her and say, does that sound right? Does the voice of the woman, and does she sound, you know, realistic? And so she would give me her opinion. So I do owe her some considerable gratitude for helping me through a few of the things where I was a bit uncertain.
Yeah. You mentioned the history, you know, the 1930s, this the time that the novel is set in. One of the things that I found interesting was, this is a period of time. The Great Depression is still raging, political life is interesting. And Nora is kind of apolitical, but caught up in it even so a little bit. And then also, this was very interesting to me, and I thought it would be interesting to do some research about this. I never knew anything about what you refer to in the book as relief camps.
Yeah. Well, relief camps, of course, the Depression was on, and you didn't have the kind of social networks that you have now. If people were unemployed, they went on relief. And going on relief was a terrible humiliation because I think it was much the same in the United States as it was in Canada. But a family on relief then had to, you had to go through a kind of means test where, you know, someone would come into your house and look around and see that you were deserving. And then they would often give you vouchers so that you went down and bought your food. They wouldn't give you money because they were afraid you might spend it on tobacco or alcohol. There was a tremendous Puritan kind of feeling about people being on relief. And some men who were single, they were sent off to relief camps, and they would do work in these camps, clearing brush and so on, and they would live in these camps, and there were sometimes labor riots in these places. I think a lot of political agitators got into these camps and fanned the fires of radicalism. There was a lot of that going on, a very interesting time, a time when, for example, communism was more respectable than it would become, both in America and in Canada. I mean, there were a lot of very well-intentioned Americans who thought that maybe communism was the way out of this terrible economic slump. Of course, it wasn't, but a lot of fairly good people thought that, and the same in Canada. Then there were socialists. There were a number of people who were looking around for ways to fix the situation. Of course, FDR, Roosevelt, came along with his New Deal, and that helped a great deal. And that was a sort of it was a sort of a form of socialism, really, in which he put a lot of people to work in government-sponsored projects, building the dams and so on. And it really did pull America, and pulling Canada too, and the rest of the world, because America economically is one of the leaders, if not the leader, and it pulled it out of the Depression, more or less. There will be people who would probably disagree with me on that, but that's the way that I've read it, that it really took the concerted effort of the government to do it.
Is history something you've written about in your previous novels?
Yeah, I've written a couple of novels which have had historical backgrounds in them. I'm very interested in history, particularly the history of the first 50 years of the century. That's the period I'm really interested in, but and American and Canadian history are the things I'm particularly intrigued by.
Another thing I was curious about is, you know, here we have Anclara and Nora, two sisters, 30-ish, and as one of them puts it, still on the shelf.
Yes.
You know, how do Clara and Nora view their situation as unmarried women? You touched on this a little bit because, you know, Clara comes to accept that, and Nora is always complaining about it. But, you know, how common or uncommon was it? Would it have been for two women, sisters, to be 30-ish and unmarried?
I suspect it would have been fairly uncommon. I mean, women married much younger in those days. I mean, women often married when they were 18, 19. And if you weren't married by 25, you began to get worried. And partly the difficulty for women in those days was the choice, was the limited choice of careers. Really, a woman was left with teaching, nursing, or secretarial work. A very few women went on to professional careers, but mostly were confined to you know, those three areas of employment. And so most women got married and were housewives. And it was a very powerful kind of social pull to get married, to be a housewife, to have children, and large families. It was quite different from the expectations of women nowadays. And that fascinated me, too, when I was researching this book and when I was thinking about writing it, the whole idea of how women's lives have changed and really how a lot of women, younger women, don't realize how recent it is that they've had the kind of freedoms that they enjoy today. So all of that was in the mix when I was sort of looking at the book in its initial stages.
Yeah. I was curious, did you want to make these women 30-ish so as to give them some heft, some maturity?
Yeah. Well, certainly that's true. I wanted to give them the weight of the years, some authority in from experience. But Nora just wants to get married, and she's a romantic in a way that Clara certainly isn't.
Mm. Do you think this would work on the stage?
Yeah, well, it's on audiobooks now, which makes it interesting as a book to listen to, and our public broadcasting system in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, did a dramatized version on radio, and it worked very well. Yeah, I think it could make a very interesting stage play with sort of backdrops and looking around and the lighting, and it would be very interesting to do on the stage.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it would be very good.
Yeah.
So we can wrap things up now here because we're at the end of the time, unfortunately. But before we go, I was curious, are you at work on a new book? Do you care to say anything about what's next?
Well, I'm at work, but I always consider it bad luck to talk about another.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I know that some writers, they're just like that. They say, no, I'm not, I won't tell you, sorry.
Take a little of the magic away from
yes.
it. Talk about it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about this novel.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Celeste. I enjoyed our conversation very much.
Take care.
Okay.
Clara Callan is the title of Richard Wright's book, and he's been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Clara Callan, a novel, is the winner of the Giller Prize and the Governor General's Prize for the year 2001. The book first published last year, 2001, in Canada to great acclaim. It's now available in the U.S., published by HarperCollins.